It is 7 o'clock. This morning we're going to have a special Sunday morning edition of Community Forum. And we have live in the studios with us this morning, Sister Jackie Hudson, who is with the Ground Zero Center for Nonviolent Action and who was recently released from a 2.5 years in federal prison for protesting at a Minuteman III nuclear missile silo down in Colorado in 2002. Jackie, thank you very much for being with us today.
Well, thank you for inviting me, Michael. It's wonderful to be here.
Let me begin and ask you, how is it that you got involved with nuclear weapons issues?
Well, I've been involved with nuclear issues since the 70s. And it was the influence of Dr. Helen Caldicott. She spoke at our college in Grand Rapids, Michigan. And being a person who was involved in many, many issues, I went home that evening from that talk thinking if I ever became more into one issue, it would be the nuclear issue. Dependent upon, really based on her talk that evening, which she continues to give around the world, actually. She's still very involved. She was a pediatrician, and she was caring for children suffering from cancer. And she decided, why treat the cancer victim? Why not go and find out why there is so much cancer? And she traced it back to the nuclear issue, its power and nuclear weapons.
And what brought you over to our neck of the woods? Because I know you used to be in Michigan.
Yes, well, we had nuclear weapons in Michigan at two of our Air Force bases. And we went, had a campaign in the mid to late 80s. And Michigan became nuclear weapons free in 1991. Both Air Force bases were closed, and sad to say, the nuclear weapons were not dismantled, but they were transferred to another Air Force base. And three of us were in jail for an action there, and when we were freed, two of the sisters went east to Jonah House in Baltimore, Maryland, and I came west to Ground Zero.
Would either of those be the same sisters that you were involved with this?
Those are the two sisters, yeah. Right. Sister Carol Gilbert and Sister Ardeth Platty.
All right.
Who are still in prison right now for this last action.
So you came out here to the Ground Zero Center for Nonviolent Action, and what made you choose that particular place?
Well, basically, because Bangor Submarine Base is one of the largest accumulations of nuclear weapons in the world. In fact, if Kitsap County were to secede from the nation and become its own little nation, it would be the third largest nuclear power in the world. United States first, then Russia, and then Kitsap County. The Trident submarine base there is, I think, one of the most lethal areas of this entire country. And we do three actions out there every year, trying to close it down, make it into a state park, national park. It's beautiful country out there, and their property on Hood Canal cannot be surpassed in beauty.
Yeah, to my understanding, there's roughly 1,780 some nuclear warheads out of that facility.
That is correct. And now we will have nuclear-tipped cruise missiles out there as well. The redoing four of the oldest Trident submarines and converting them to carry nuclear-tipped or conventionally-tipped cruise missiles. And I feel that the next war that we preemptively attack some nation again, that there will be submarines from Bangor, I believe, involved in that.
So tell us, how is it that you ended up working on choosing a facility in Colorado for your action?
Well, Bangor is so heavily secure from water and land, there was no way to do a plowshare action at Submarine Base Bangor. So we were together for about 9 months. There were a larger group than the three who planned and worked and prayed and studied the issues. And we decided to do Colorado, because of the home base of planning for war in space is in Colorado Springs. And the Minuteman III missile silos are spread throughout the northeastern corner of Colorado. There are 49 Minuteman III missile silos in the northeastern corner of Colorado. So in order to, and they consider themselves the kill chain in the Colorado, the state. It actually starts down in Albuquerque with Kirtland Air Force Base, where they have nuclear weapons there, and comes right on up through Colorado Springs with Schriever Air Force Base, Peterson Air Force Base, NORAD is right there. And then on up to the Air Force Academy, and then we are on the outskirts of Denver in the city of Aurora, where they have converted a National Guard air base to a U.S. Air Force base, which is the main receiver station for the information coming from our satellites.
So you selected this area for its ties also to our space program.
Right, that is correct. Our space program, we're planning to fight in and from outer space. In fact, we have been. This war in Iraq that's going on right now is basically being fought from space. The information that they're getting and transmitting is through satellites. So that we actually are fighting from space at this point. We're not shooting our lasers and our weaponry from there, but we are getting our information to fight on the ground and in the air from outer space. There's a quote that I just think is so powerful that came from the Air Force personnel themselves. And The Air Force personnel is saying that in order to exploit space, we have to dominate it. And the fact that we have been the Air Force 2020 plan that came out in the 90s actually talked about the exploitation of outer space and the domination of outer space and disallowing any other nation into outer space. And a representative from Florida stated that the only way that we could do that is to, you know, continue with the space program right now as it is and expand it. And that would lead us to control the destiny of the Earth. Now, if we're talking about empire, we're not just talking about empire here on Earth. We're talking about owning the entire creation. It's mind-boggling what our military has in their plans today. I just never dreamed that I would be living in a United States of America that we are living in today.
Yeah, the military's, I think it's the Vision 2020 plan.
Yes. Is that?
And my understanding is it's a direct violation, actually, of international law conventions that the U.S. is a signatory to, that the space would always be there for everyone's use.
Exactly. We have signed treaties that space is for all, and space would only be used for peaceful purposes. But, you know, with the president that we have in power right now, treaties mean nothing. We've just done away with the ABM treaty. We are not abiding by the non-proliferation treaty at all. That's the one that they're discussing at the United Nations right now, and they're spending the month of May with the NPT review. And built into that treaty is a five-year review process. And 2005, they're really concerned that that treaty is just going to go by the wayside because of the United States disagreeing and disallowing the process to continue. The NPT actually calls for total nuclear disarmament worldwide. Not unilaterally, but worldwide in an orderly fashion. But the problem is there's never been a timeline set for this to take place. And it calls for the five nuclear nations that at the time when the treaty was signed would work toward disarmament, and that all other nations that signed, which is 180 some nations, and they in their signature said they would not seek nuclear weapons. But now it seems to be a free-for-all. Israel has had them for years and has denied it. India and Pakistan, and now we're accusing Iran, because we know that nuclear power is basically producing material to produce nuclear weapons.
So this all ties back into your selection of Colorado and what...
Correct. In fact, we went to Colorado in 2000. In the year 2000. Basically, it was the first reading of the 2020 master plan of the Air Force that talking about domination and exploitation of outer space that I read, and I couldn't believe that our government would be thinking along such lines. And we studied that document, and that drew us to Colorado Springs for the first action. And we did an action at an air show there in the year 2000 and poured blood and hammered on receiving plate for the MILSTAR satellite.
And then you decided that something more had to be done?
Correct. We, at that point... We were jailed for little less than a week, and they denied that any blood or anyone had even touched the MILSTAR satellite dish, and we were released. So we went back. We really felt the need to sound an alarm to the nation as to what is happening in the state of Colorado, and that's why we went to the... In July of 2002, President Bush came on publicly and stated that we would attack with nuclear weapons any nation that threatened our security. At this point, we were talking seriously about going back into Iraq, and that is so utterly against international law that we felt we needed to do something drastic. So we decided that we would go as citizen weapons inspections team and inspect and expose and symbolically disarm one nuclear weapon from the state of Colorado. Because when we get into nuclear disarmament, you can only do it one weapon at a time. So we thought... George Bush was looking for nuclear weapons in Iraq with the inspection teams over there and not finding them. And we thought, hey, we know where there's one, and we will go and expose expose to the world one of our own and symbolically disarm it. Now, we symbolically disarmed it through a plowshare action. And a plowshare action... it was the 20th anniversary in 2000 when we did our action. But the symbolism of the plowshare action is the use of human blood, our own blood, and the use of household hammers. Our own blood from the symbolism that we would rather shed our blood than see the blood of innocent people shed. And the use of household hammers, because that is what is used to tear down what is not needed and to build up what is needed. So those are the two symbolic materials that are used in a plowshare action. So we chose N8. The 49 missile silo sites are named by a letter and a number. And they're set in pods of 10. And each pod of 10 has a control center, underground control center that is Air Force personnel are operating those on a 24/7 basis. And they go down and they live in this underground area. I can't think of what their time frame, whether it's a week at a time, but it's a limited time because they're out of contact with anyone except their own military personnel at the time. So we chose N8. It was up on a hill. It was along the main highway east-west between the interstate and Greeley, Colorado. And we they're just sitting out in farmers' fields. This one was on a ranch. And so we chose it for its location. And in doing our actions, we don't do them clandestinely in the sense of finding a secluded place, but we'd rather find a very public place and then stay and wait for the military to arrive. And in this case, we clipped one link in a chain for the farmer's fence at the county road level, and then we clipped one link of a chain, not disturbing the lock at all. They would have only had to come in and open the lock and flip it into the next link, actually. And we opened both of those gates and went in and found the missile silo actually humming. The motors were going, that they keep air control and so on. It's a very scientific process that they have there at the silo. And we poured our blood in the shape of crosses on this 110-ton concrete silo cover. And then down along the side of it, it's about a 6-foot high, like a wall, on that cement is our railroad tracks that the cover can slide back in order to inspect and to clean, which they do routinely during the course of the year. And after we had poured our blood in the shape of crosses on those tracks, thinking of the tracks that go into Auschwitz and Dachau and how that had brought so many millions to their death, and this weapon itself, armed with three nuclear, independently targeted nuclear warheads, could destroy millions of innocent people as well. And after we had done that, we went over and clipped three sections of the chain link fence from the inside and laid them down to the outside to expose it to the world. And then we went back onto the missile silo cover and had a liturgy, prayer and song that we had brought with us and prepared it in advance. We also brought with us books that would testify to the illegality of this missile and left those on the site as well. And when the military came 45 minutes later, which again is, security, this was, if we had really wanted to do damage, we could have done it and disappeared without anyone ever knowing. But no, this isn't what we do. We waited for the military to come and to try to explain to them that they were protecting an illegal weapon at this site and that they should themselves discard this particular job that they were doing. Of course, that's not what happened.
What was your interaction with the people that arrived?
Well, at the initial arrival, they came in like it was an attack of Iraq or Afghanistan or wherever. They came in crashing through the fence. They destroyed two of the gates coming in with their Humvees and their M60 cannon on the top of the Humvee, and they came out of the vehicle with their M16s with grenade launchers. And all I could describe it was, it was like being at a high school basketball game where there was just such overwhelming sound. They were shouting and you couldn't make out anything that they were saying. But then after we were let out from the site and placed face down and on the ground outside of the missile silo site, that's when we had an opportunity. Each of us was guarded by three. We had two people, one kneeling on us and holding our cuffed hands behind our backs with their hand. And in front of us was another military personnel with the M16 on us, each of us. And we were separated. So we had an opportunity to speak with three for quite some time.
And did you have any meaningful conversations there? Because I know that from past actions that I've seen members of the Ground Zero Center for Nonviolent Action participate in, that's an often important exchange is during the arrest process.
That is correct. And, you know, these were young folk, you know, 18, 19-year-old women and men. They needed women to come, so we were held a little bit longer, I think, because of the need for women to be called to come. But just young folk, and so dedicated, really feeling that they are protecting the people of the United States, and without a clue that there is such a thing as international law, and that they are not obligated to follow illegal orders. So it's kind of a brainwashing process I feel that they go through, and it really is difficult to counter that. They really feel they are doing tremendous service to all of us. I mean, how often we hear, well, you couldn't do this unless, you know, we were here doing this, you know, what we're doing. That's sort of a mantra from the military. But it's just, it was a very instructive time for both of us, I believe, to hear the two, hear the two angles on what was happening.
So what was the legal response to the judicial response?
The military responded first, and then the Weld County Sheriff's Department arrived, and then the FBI agent from Wyoming arrived, and then the bomb squad flew in by helicopter from Wyoming. So there was quite a massive response from law enforcement. There, we had carried in with us, because we didn't know how long we would be there, we had water and granola bars and something that would sustain us if we were going to be there any length of time. And, of course, they taking the most sinister look at it, thought that there could be weaponry and there could be bombs in that. So they had to call in the bomb squad that came by helicopter, and they had to suit up in their material or their outfits that were bomb resistant before they would open up the backpacks and my little canvas bag. And so it was, it's kind of sad that we live in such a an atmosphere that any item such as that is taken as being a possible weapon, although we had told them exactly what was in the bags.
Now, did you go to jail immediately, and then what was the court proceedings like?
Well, we were taken to Weld County Jail by the sheriff's office and charged with state charges of trespass and mischievous vandalism, I believe was the charge. And we were held for 15 days in Weld County Jail before the U.S. government decided what charges they would bring against us. And we were picked up by the FBI agent that had been at the scene and driven to Denver. And we were arraigned in Denver very quickly and taken to a county jail out about 45 miles east or west of Denver, out in the little town of Georgetown, little gold mining town, and Clear Creek County Jail. And we were held there and brought in where we thought we would be arraigned on trespass and maybe depredation of government property is usually the charge. And there we were met by an attorney that we didn't know at all. And he said that I have indicted us by the grand jury of sabotage and also depredation of government property. So when we went in for the arraignment, the judge cited those two charges and suggested that we get an attorney To face these charges, because we were looking at 30 years in prison and $250,000 fine for this charge of 2155 in Title 18. So we were taken back to the Clear Creek County Jail. This is now October. And we had a trial set immediately for the beginning of November. Well, we petitioned immediately for an extension, and were denied. But as soon as we agreed to have an attorney, they petitioned for an extension and received it. So the trial did not take place actually until April of 2003. So we were in the Clear Creek County Jail during that period. We were offered personal recognizance release, which would have brought us back to our communities, and back and forth and back and forth for the different court appearances prior to trial. And we decided that in solidarity with the women that we had been in jail with there, who had some of them had been there a year, year and a half awaiting trial and offered no bond and offered no release of any kind, in solidarity with them, we decided to stay in county jail. And also, it would be cost prohibitive to make all those trips back from the East Coast and West Coast to Denver. So we were in county jail for 7 months in Clear Creek County. Little basement room, could not see outside, never saw fresh the air outside, or never smelt fresh air. It was a very, very small enclosure and always overcrowded. Very interesting 7 months.
For those of you just tuning in, we are talking with Sister Jackie Hudson. She is with the Ground Zero Center for Nonviolent Action, and talking about the issues related to her 2.5 years in federal prison for protesting at a Minuteman III nuclear missile silo in Colorado. So, Jackie, then from there, when did you finally go to court and tell us what has been going on with your court case, how you kind of ended up here?
Well, we went into a week-long trial in which the judge denied us any defenses. He gave a 32-page denial of any defense that we had asked to use. Basically, international law was not to be mentioned. The Nuremberg defenses were not to be brought up. It was just complete denial that of any of the defenses that we had prepared would be allowed to be spoken in court. Our expert witnesses were denied access to the jury. They were allowed to testify to the judge himself at a preliminary hearing, but denied being listened to or heard during the trial by the jury. So, which was very interesting, because one of the expert witnesses was from the University of Denver, who was this judge's teacher at one point. So he was very happy, you know, and he listened very intently, or he seemed to be listening very intently. And when Vednanda said that these weapons are illegal and against international law, and that what we did was a perfectly legal action as a right and duty and privilege of a citizen of the United States, knowing that this law is being broken, that it is our duty to do an action to bring this to the public and to make it known to our government. This is governed by the Nuremberg principles, where we where we prosecuted German soldiers for following orders which were illegal orders and illegal actions. So we were bringing to light the criminal activity of the United States government. And this was testified to by both Francis Boyle, who is an international law expert from University of Illinois Urbana, and by Vednanda from the law department of the University of Denver. Very interesting. He listened to it. We had brought Francis Boyle's book and left it on the site, feeling that the government always brings the evidence that is left at the there called Crime Scene, and is allowed to be testified to in the court process. Well, our judge said that we could use the cover of the book only, nothing from the book itself. But the cover of the book could be seen by the jury. But that was it. So we were just hamstrung as far as any particular defense. We stipulated to what we did. We told the entire story of the entire action, why we came, and what we actually did when we got there, was all told by the three of us as we took the stand. But the intent, our intent, was to publicize and to bring out the criminality that this was a crime scene. But the intent that was taken by the court was that we had driven from Michigan to Colorado to protest. We don't believe that what we did was a protest at all. It was a revealing of a criminal activity. But the specific intent to prove a guilty charge on this 2155 statute is that we specifically came to interfere with the national defense of the United States of America and knew that what we were doing would explicitly interfere with that national defense and security of this country. And that was just sort of disregarded. And just because the intent that we had come there to a nuclear site, it was a political trial from the very beginning. We felt if we had a legal trial, we would be acquitted, and if we had a political trial, we would be convicted. And it was political from the get-go. In fact, it really went into the politics. We lost the case and went back to jail and waited sentencing. Sentencing was scheduled. This was May 1st that we were found guilty, and sentencing was scheduled for July 25th. And in the meantime, we decided we were facing a minimum of 8 years, the prosecutor said. So we decided after a few weeks that we would ask to for the personal recognizance bond again, and come back to our homes. And what we did is we came home and did away with our clothing and saw friends and visited family and said goodbye to folks that we knew would not be living 8 years from now, and went back for the sentencing in July. So we did have a little break in our jail time between the trial and sentencing.
Talk about what jail time was like. Were you in an all-women's prison?
Well, after sentencing, we were separated. Carol was designated to Alderson, West Virginia, one of the oldest, well, it is the oldest women's federal prison in the country. Ardeth was designated to Danbury, Connecticut, and I was designated to Victorville, California, the newest women's camp in the country. Federal prison is legalized slavery in the 21st century. These prison situations, it was entitled a work camp. It was out in the southwestern corner of the Mojave Desert on an abandoned or discarded Air Force base, George Air Force Base, a highly contaminated area. They had built the camp for 300 women, and there were one facility, a medium security facility for men across the street that was visible. And while I was there, they completed the building of the newest federal penitentiary for men, which would hold 2,000 men, and also another medium security facility for men for 1,700. So the women were there helping to open up these two new facilities. raking rocks, painting the interior, setting up the metal detectors, carrying mattresses into the cells, and setting up the tables and assembling the furniture for the dining hall. It was very heavy physical labor. And the women were called and forced to work extra shifts, especially if there was an inspection coming or some visitors coming to see the facility. The women were called out, even worked all night, and then had to get up and work their morning shift. The work day started at 7. So we had lights on at 6 in the morning. Breakfast was available until 7. Work call, general work call, was at 7 o'clock, and people had to be reporting to work at that time. And then there's an official count throughout the entire prison system at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. So work release was usually by 3:30, so that they would be back to the dormitory. We had to be standing at our bunks for the 4 o'clock count. So it was and they came back for lunch as well. So there was a lot of walking involved. The penitentiary was about, between a quarter and a half mile walk to work, back and forth. And in the meantime, like I say, once they opened the penitentiary, they opened it with a busload of men that they brought down from Lompoc, California. And they were used to the rules at Lompoc where they could smoke. Well, any new facility now that's going up is a non-smoking facility. So the men rioted immediately. And so then it was up to the women to go over and make lunches and provide the food. Well, by the time before I left, there were between 300 and 500 men now that they had brought down. And so the shifts were, and they were continually locking them down, which meant that they were locked in their cells. And so the women were doing their work as well as going over and doing the feeding of them as well. And like I say, it was, there's no choice in the matter. You will go. And it was a very interesting, dehumanizing. We're intellectual property. We're not human beings. And human beings have feelings. Property doesn't. In fact, some of the food was labeled in the women working. The women did all the work. They did the kitchen work. They did the landscaping. They did all of the caretaking of all the buildings, the commissary, the warehouse. And there would actually be boxes that they would be opening in the cafeteria in the kitchen area that said not for human consumption. And how they get away with this, well, there's no way to document it. It's your word against a guard's word, and you know where that's going to lead.
And did you see evidence of private corporations being involved with this slave labor situation?
Well, at our camp, Every women's prison and every men's prison is involved with something different. The women at our camp, working for Unicor, which is a government prison work system, were working on Humvees. They were bringing Humvees back from Iraq and Afghanistan, and also Fort Ord, where the training, the desert training, was taking place. And they would take the transmissions out, and those transmissions then would be transported to the men's prison, where they would do the overhaul of the transmission. The women, in the meantime, would be doing the paint chipping and repainting. In fact, there were several women with eye injuries from the sanding, because they were not given protective goggles while they were doing this electric sanding of these vehicles. And broken bones, they were still forced to go and work with broken wrist or broken ankle. And it was just like almost impossible. If someone told me about it, I would have a hard time believing it, as people do have a hard time believing me saying what my experience was. But and the medical care was next to nothing. the pills of choice were Benadryl and Tylenol. Anything that you had would be cured by Benadryl or Tylenol. And there were women suffering from, well, one was diagnosed with cancer 18 months after she had pleaded with them to get her to a doctor for an examination. So it's very totally inhumane that's going on in our prison systems today. You know, you read the paper and they say, oh, they're coddling these prisoners. Why, they even have a television. Sure, we had three televisions for 150 women, and those were only to be used during free time, which it's first choice, first come, first serve. And there's always, you know, little domination groups in a system such as that. So it's far from coddling.
It's interesting that people there were working on the Humvees in light of the continuing mounting evidence of the U.S. use of depleted uranium weapons in those theaters. And then basically it sounds to me then having prison labor here in this country then doing the nasty job of cleaning that off.
Right. Which, you know, is an issue that really hasn't been approached as far as I know. The contamination issue. We had women that did have surgical procedures done in the city. They were taken into the town of Victorville, and when they came back, the prison doctor actually told them not to wash in the water, but to wash in bottled water that they bought at the commissary, and because of the contamination in the water. So they knew that they were exposing everyone, you know, to the PCBs and whatever you find on an abandoned Air Force base. And then to buy water, it was like 95 cents a bottle. Salaries range from 12 cents an hour. Like I received a minimum salary of $5.25 for the month. And if I had to depend upon my own work salary from prison, I would not have been able to buy shampoo or soap or laundry soap or anything. It's you're totally dependent upon outside help, because the commissary prices are comparable to or more expensive than you would find in your local grocery stores. But I always joke that it would 3 hours labor wouldn't even buy me a postage stamp to write a letter home.
And with that commissary, was that a government-run store?
Well, that's a prison-run system. In fact, the prison commissary, we were allowed to shop once a week. You submitted your list and then went and picked it up later. But the commissary list itself was, next to impossible. Like a six-pack of Coke, for instance, cost $2.40. Now, that would be a half month's salary for me. But an 8-ounce jar of Folgers coffee, instant coffee, was $5.70. And a small box of Tide, $5.10. A typewriter ribbon. We did have access to an IBM typewriter, but you had to bring your own ribbon. And those were like $8.20. So, and copies were available, but they were 13 cents a copy. Telephone was 23 cents a minute. So there is a lot of money being made in the prison system today. In fact, when the American Corrections officers get together for their conferences, the main exhibitors are AT&T, Helene Curtis, Procter & Gamble, all these trying to get contracts with the federal system to sell their product. AT&T, for instance, figures that they made $12,000 on every payphone that was present in a prison. And in our camp, we had six. Now, I don't know how many were across at the penitentiary and at the two medium security, and that was just one facility in the United States. So there's billions being made by the corporate America on prisons. And they keep building, and they keep imprisoning women, particularly women right now. There's been a tremendous increase in the number of women being imprisoned. And most of them that came in, the majority were drug involved. And not use of drugs or distributing of drugs, but conspiracy, in which there is no defense. Someone gave their name, and they were brought in and found guilty and prosecuted. There was an interesting book called Constitutional Chaos, written by a judge from New Jersey. And he was saying that in 2002, less than 3% of the federal cases being prosecuted were brought to trial because they threaten the women with 25, 30 years, 40 years, some of them, and if they don't plea bargain. And if they plea bargain, they're actually admitting guilt of some sort. So then they go to a plea bargain and receive 7 to 10 years. And this is tearing our, you know, this family-oriented society that we're talking about, family values all the time. They're tearing families apart. Many of these women had small children. Some of them came in pregnant. Some of them came in leaving a 2-month, 3-month-old baby at home with a grandmother or an aunt or as a ward of the court. Families meant nothing. And if less than 3% are brought to trial and found guilty, then they throw the book at them. We had women in there for 20, 25 years and went in 19, 20 at the time. And it's criminal what's happening in the criminal so-called justice system. It's an injustice system as far as I'm concerned.
Did you know of what was going on in the prison system?
Oh yes. It's we knew some of what was going on, but to witness it firsthand was very frustrating, because there's nothing. You have no access. You have guards that feel that they are just nobody can do anything. Women would write guards up for misconduct. Or over processing in some issues, and they would get nowhere, and then there would be retaliation. Of course, they would deny that it was retaliation. They would always find the rules. The rule book was written in such a way that if ever they wanted to pin something down on you, they could. It wasn't followed as a regular, process or a way of life there. You were kept totally unsure. They could enforce whatever, and they always had the little inclusion at the end, you know, or anything related, or anything that you see fit, or as the condition or the situation showed, so that they could bring in anything at any time, and you were always in the wrong. And it was like a little mini trial that they would bring you to. And then your sanction would be no commissary for a month or two, no access to a telephone, which was your only contact for many of the women, because they were moved so far away from home that the only contact they had with their families was by telephone. So they either, it was a sanction of no visiting, or no telephone, or no commissary, or a combination of any of them, or extra labor.
Well, we have just under 10 minutes left, and I wanted to make sure that we cover the reasons why you did this. Currently, we're looking at, I believe, in New York, there's a lot of people have been traveling there for forums on the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. Can you talk about the bigger issues that you see hinging on right now?
Well, every 5 years, when they do the review of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, the nations come together and try to get it so it would be an operative treaty. And the United States this year has refused to agree to an agenda. In fact, I don't know if they have an agenda yet, and they began this the beginning of May. So a lot of folks are very have a sort of a defeatist attitude as to what's going to happen at this 2005 review. In fact, they see the treaty going toward extinction, not only because of the lack of attention to it and the lack of abiding by it, but outright disregard for the treaty. And our present president seems so as if treaties don't call him to any accountability. Accountability is not a word, it seems as though, that's in vogue in Washington, D.C. Today. Our lack of understanding that when we sign a treaty, it means something, seems to be gone. And not only is it an international treaty, but it's also part of the United States Constitution. On Article 6, Section 2 of the U.S. Constitution claims that any treaty signed by this government of the United States supersedes local, state, national law. So that was one of the issues that we were disallowed to speak of at our trial, that there is a supremacy law, that international law supersedes, and that these treaties are solemn promises, as it were. And we seem to disregard or any sense of being accountable to what has been signed. So the fact of what's happening in New York right now, there are many, many people there working to make sure that the Non-Proliferation Treaty does not go extinct at the end of this review session. I believe it's a Sri Lankan judge who wrote the opinion of the International Court of Justice declaring nuclear weapons illegal is at this conference. In fact, our international lawyers that were involved in our trial are there to speak with him and bring our case to him so that he is aware of what's still going on in this country, of the disregard for international law. We petitioned and appealed to the appeals court on our case. And the appeals court came back with a denial again and upheld the district court's guilty charge. And then we petitioned also the entire 10th Circuit to hear the case, or to at least review the case, and that petition was denied about 2 weeks ago now. So our court process is ended at this point. We have no further appeals. The next state would be to take it to the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court. And the attorneys at this stage feel that the process thus far would prove that it would be to no avail to take our case to the Supreme Court, that the justices would not rule against the district federal court on a nuclear weapons in an international law case. So at this point, we are now in the process. I have been released now since March 4th. Carol will be released this month, May 23rd, and Ardith will be released on December 5th. We were sentenced for the same action, but went from 2.5 years to 3.5 years because of our criminal history. So how the federal guidelines for sentencing work. So that's why we are at different stages. Now I am in the process, I've started my 3 years of probation. So I was actually sentenced to 5.5 years. Probation is living on a short leash of one person in a probation department controlling your life. And so that's where I am personally, and where Carol and Ardith will be when we must report within 72 hours to the probation office after upon release from prison. That's because we're so utter, terrible criminals.
Yeah, you're a dangerous example.
Oh, yes, danger to society.
So just a couple minutes left. What do you recommend to others to do in terms of our nuclear dilemma, since it appears that our elected officials are not taking the reins on this?
Well, I believe that we have to become much more vocal. And I don't think we've done the letter writing, we've done the lobbying. I think it's going to take a much more drastic action on the part of more and more people. Now, I realize that there were millions in the streets of the world, and it didn't stop our preemptive action in Iraq. But it was a one day. I think we're going to need a much more continued in the streets demanding change. And this is going to require a big sacrifice for a lot more of us. We applaud the sacrifice of our military personnel for giving up time from their families. They're separated. They're into a situation that you would not normally choose. And I think peacemakers need to do something similar, that the sacrifice level has to increase in order to be effective. And when that's going to happen, what is going to create that point in our people's minds and hearts, I don't know. I hope it isn't going to be such a disaster that would bring that about. I would hope that we could come to that in a peaceful manner. I believe the revolution is coming, and I pray that it's going to be a nonviolent revolution. We cannot go on the way we are.
All right. Well, I want to thank you for spending time with us this morning.
Thank you for inviting me, Mike.
We have just been speaking with Sister Jackie Hudson. She is with the Ground Zero Center for Nonviolent Action. And you can find out more about the Ground Zero Center for Nonviolent Action and updates on Jackie's situation through their website, which is at www.gzcenter.org.